And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show, your final Total Soccer Show episode of the week. My name is Taylor Rockwell. With me today to talk Olympic qualifying, to talk U.S. senior roster, and to talk the UEFA Champions League draw is a man who will harbor no slander against Tassani Dotson. It's Joe Lowry. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Taylor. That is 100% factual.
So last night after the USA's 1-0 win over Costa Rica in their opening game of Olympic qualifying, Joe and I did a little over an hour on stereo about the game. We did a kind of quick take, hot take. We answered some questions and we left it with what are some things that we maybe need to review? What are some things we want to go back and watch? One of the only things I think we mildly, not even definitely, but mildly disagreed on is I was a little bit cooler on Tassani Dotson's performance. Joe was a little bit more positive. Joe was having none of it, and we'll find out where we are later on in this episode. As I said, we're also going to talk about the senior U.S. men's roster, which has been released for their upcoming friendlies. We're going to talk UEFA Champions League draw, which has now taken place. But first, we're going to start with that Olympic qualifier. Joe, before we even get to tactics or lineups or roster or anything that happened in the game, how exciting was it to just watch meaningful soccer? We talked about this at the very beginning of our stereo show. Some folks might have missed that one, and we know that our general audience wasn't listening, so we should probably revisit that one for a moment, because I was pretty pumped to watch this game and have it matter.
It was fun, right? It was fun, but also not fun. And that's also what soccer is. That's what watching soccer that you care about is. It's really great.
Yeah, man.
When things are going well, or the build up to it's really great. And then you kind of turn into a little bit of a nervous wreck during it. And I mean, I wasn't biting my fingernails or anything in this one, but it reminded me of what it feels like to watch a soccer game that you care about. And that's a pretty cool feeling after how strange and weird and terrible in some ways the last year's been.
Yeah, man. That's really well said, that it was like fun and not fun. And that is such, sadly, unless you're like a Bayern or Barcelona fan, right, lately, but maybe just a Bayern fan. Like, sadly, there is always going to be those moments of like, ooh, this isn't going well. And you're right that even at like, as I'm like supporting Manchester United, I have those moments where it's like, oh, this isn't going well. They're like, oh, I hope they see this game out. But it still is never really going to resonate with me as much as I think U.S. teams will. And so in this game, when the U.S. goes up, I was out of my chair. I was really excited when they scored. I was really nervous. I don't think I was chewing my nails. I'm looking at them. They seem like they're okay. But I was definitely really anxious, especially in that second half, as it felt like Costa Rica could get back into it. They did have a few chances. Luckily, Jason Christ made the decision to start a wall in goal, so they were not able to score. But I'm with you. It was a pretty exciting game, I think partially because the game itself was just exciting and partially because it was just nice to feel feelings about soccer in that way again.
Yeah, exactly. And the U.S. get that 1-0 win over Costa Rica in this game. And it's such a weird tournament. It's such a weird opportunity, yeah, a weird roster, because it's a U23, technically a U24 competition, because it got pushed back a year from when these games were supposed to happen in 2020. So it's already a strange age group. It's not a competition that clubs have to release players for. So the guys you see on this roster are mostly MLS-based players who aren't in season right now, which is great that they can be called in and play in these games. But also, we saw it in this match against Costa Rica. That hurts that they're not in season, because they don't look sharp. They don't look fit.
Yeah.
They faded down the stretch against Costa Rica, whereas Costa Rica were still going, because 85% of Costa Rica's roster is in season right now. I think 17 of their 20 players, that's probably more than 85%. I'm not doing math right now. But a large portion of Costa Rica's roster plays either in Costa Rica, which has a league that's going right now, or they play in Europe, which is also going right now in most countries. So a really strange juxtaposition. in terms of where these players are at in their calendar years. But that just added to the entertainment because it's a weird time, it's a weird game, and it was fun, man.
It sure was. I'm going to take a shot and say it's 85% is my poor math. And I am not good at math.
That's exactly what I said. I think I nailed that one. Wow.
There we go, man. There we go. All right. Joe, let's start with that roster. Let's start with that starting 11 then, because as you said, it is a strange one. The Soccer 101 episode that I have now finally published is about why Olympic soccer isn't as popular as the World Cup, sort of getting into the history of the Olympics and soccer at the Olympics, the changes that have been made, how we kind of got to the point where we're at today. And as you've already said, what that tends to mean is that we're not getting all of the possible players that could be playing for this Olympic team. We're getting the players that were made available. And even in some cases, we had MLS teams not releasing their players. Atlanta United held back, what, two or three? So we aren't getting the full strength team that we could possibly be getting. But we did get some good performances. We did get some exciting names in that starting 11. Who were you most excited to see in the 11 for whatever reason? Could be because we didn't see it coming. Could be because we did and we just wanted to see them play.
There were four guys that I was really excited to see of this starting group. So David Ochoa in goal, we talked about him on our preview show. We didn't expect him to start necessarily. We kind of thought JT Marcinkowski was going to start, but Ochoa comes in as the youngest player on this roster. Christ made that decision late in camp to give him the opening start, and he was great. So, but even before we knew he was great, I was excited because I've really liked him in the past. We saw him at the U20 World Cup in 2019, where he took that starting job from Brady Scott midway through the group stage. And then we've also seen him in USL for the Real Monarchs. He's won a championship starting in goal for them and is just waiting for a chance at RSL. So I was really excited for Ochoa. I was really excited for Mauricio Pineda. I called him the best passing center back on the roster before this game, and I still think that's true, but we'll get into that more later. Sam Vines is the third one for me just because you and I both really liked him after January camp. And even dating back to January camp 2020, where that game against Costa Rica's senior team was in February, Sam Vines, I thought, was pretty fun in that game as well. And then number four, Jesus Ferreira, just because he really is a factor for the senior team right now as well. He's not just a U23/U24 player. He's a guy that Greg Berhalter is looking at almost as the prototype for what he wants that number nine position to look like. And so the more chances we get to see him for a U.S. team, I think the better.
Yeah, I'm going to echo some of what you've already said, starting with Evan Ochoa, who is a player that, like, going back to the Top Drawer Soccer Show and my conversations with Travis Clark, that's a player that he's been really excited about for a very long time. And there's an element of, like, though I have seen Evan Ochoa playing professional soccer and playing for various U.S. youth national teams, there's an element of, like, the Josh Gattness thing of, like, I know there's this very good goalkeeper out there who I haven't really seen play that much, but I know he's there, and people seem really hyped about him. Chituro Odunze at senior level is another one of those. Like, I know there's a good goalkeeper that I keep hearing about, but I haven't yet gotten the chance to see him, really. But you're right. We saw Ochoa with that U20 World Cup squad, and even then, it was sort of this, like, okay, I'm excited to see what comes next, and to see this be the thing that comes next, at least in my mind, and that thing being a shutout performance where he does so many different things that I really, really enjoyed, not just making saves, but his positioning, his decision-making, the gamesmanship, a little bit of CONCACAFery, some trash-talking. It was a complete performance. So I loved what I saw from David Ochoa, and I continue to back Sam Vines. I drafted him in my Quidditch team when Adam and I did that show. I also drafted Yunus Musa, and I will forever take credit for him now declaring to play for the U.S. I'm assuming those two things are linked.
Of course.
But I feel really good about drafting Sam Vines, because in this game, I don't think anybody necessarily, aside from David Ochoa, had an A-plus game, but I thought Sam Vines did well, given that he was tasked with getting forward and helping create opportunities, and he does for the goal. But he was also tracking Costa Rica's most dangerous player and dealing with a pretty consistent overload in that second half, and I thought he did about as well as he could have. So I'm with you on those two for sure. And then Jesus Ferreira. Oh, did I want to see me some Jesus Ferreira? Because it felt like he's strangely a senior player in this team. You could hear him on mic at times, coaching people and talking to people about their positioning and where they need to be. I thought his positioning across the board was pretty solid as well. So yeah, I'm with you on three of those four in terms of how enthusiastic I was. The Pineda one is just because I wasn't as familiar as you. But I think we're on the same page about the players that we did get to see. We did not get to see Yulianez. Quick mention there. He was forced to withdraw from this camp. I don't believe it was a personal issue. I think it was an injury related thing. Correct. Where they just weren't sure he was going to be up for the fitness. And in this competition where there is going to be a lot of heat and a lot of humidity and a lot of running, you do have to have as strong of a team as you can and as physically competitive of a team as you can. So I do understand why he has to leave, why Tanner Tessman comes in. Still sad not to see him in the 11, but I'm sure we'll see Uli Yanez in the near future once again.
I'm going back just a minute or two here, but listeners, for those of you who had Taylor Turns Josh Gatt into an adjective on your TSS bingo cards, go ahead and cross that one off right now. You are 1/5 of your way to bingo. Congrats.
He's one of those, I tweeted this a while ago about players that like we heard about for so long and never really saw, or there were players that were kind of rumored to be eligible.
Yeah.
And it got turned into like players who didn't meet their potential, which isn't what I was looking for, but there was like Josh Gatt. The other one that comes to mind is, Evgeny/Eugene Starikov, who was playing in the Russian Premier League, I think still is, but never really like made it to that next level where he was a regular with the U.S. national team. So I think of those types of players as almost like mythical, hyped up, talked about, but like you can't really find footage of them and you're not really sure how good they are. But David Ochoa, we now know, is very, very good. So that makes me happy.
I love it, Taylor. I love it.
That's good. So we've talked a little bit about the team, about some of the names we had. We did see the U.S. in a 4-3-3. I continued to think there was a chance we might see a sort of Jason Kreis 4-4-2, a little bit of a diamond there. We did not, which then kind of connects to the idea that this is a team trying to replicate what the senior team is doing with that same general shape. Greg Berhalter doesn't love saying that it's a 4-3-3 or any sort of specific formation, but roughly speaking, that's what it was. Joe, were there other similarities you saw between this team and the senior team?
I thought it was almost a carbon copy of what we saw from Greg mm-hmm. Berhalter starting in that January camp game in 2020 against Costa Rica, then moving into, I believe, the November games were the next games after that. Against Wales and Panama. And it's that 4-3-3 that Berhalter has changed to. Yeah, in the past, he possessed sometimes in a shape that roughly resembled that. But defensively, it was a 4-4-2 mid-block when he first took over. And I think he upgraded the defensive setup and made it more aggressive and changed it to that Liverpool-esque 4-3-3 press. If you'd Men in Blacked me, Taylor, I assume you've seen Men in Black. Mm-hmm. And they have that little, you know, clicker thing that makes you forget
flashy
stuff.
Thing.
Yeah, the flashy thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd flashy thinged me, And I'd forgotten, you know, everything about this competition. And I'd forgotten that it was a U24 competition coached by Jason Kreis. And then I'd open my eyes and sat down in front of the computer and watched this game. I would have thought this was a Greg Berhalter team. And that's not to say, you know, that Jason Kreis can't coach or whatever. I'm not trying to get into that at the moment. But I'm just saying this team really strongly resembled the senior team, which I think is important. I think that's the type of tactical setup that the U.S. is trying to integrate all the way down from the senior team down to the U23s, down to the U20s, down to the U17s. This is the system that the United States is trying to run. Greg Berhalter is trying to change the way the world views American soccer. Those are his words, not about himself, but about what he's trying to do with this team right now, this senior team. And the way you do that, or at least the way you do that on the men's side of things, because the women are doing that in their own really impressive way. But on the men's side of things, the way you elevate this men's program is by playing a style of soccer that makes you stand out. And the U.S. stood out yesterday against Costa Rica. The way they were trying to play and the style they're trying to execute is so hard. It's really challenging to put together. And the U.S. didn't do it flawlessly, but the fact that they emulated the senior team's tactics very closely made me happy, because I think that's an important step to unifying the men's side of the program.
So I don't disagree with you, like fundamentally. I think where I maybe like take issue or have a slight difference is that I saw them doing some things that seemed very familiar, but I saw them not doing other things that I think limited what they were trying to do. And I will try to make that more clear, but I wanted to just like initially propose the idea that this is kind of my take on what you've said, Joe. And then I look forward to you, tearing it apart and telling me why I'm wrong. But basically it's that 4-3-3. I think what we didn't have as much though was so much creativity through the middle. And I do feel like the senior team does try to do that at least a little bit. I feel like they do try to pass and connect some kind of sequences through the center, through that midfield three. I don't think we saw that as much yesterday against Costa Rica. And I think that is a lot to do with the personnel that like Hassani Dotson, I do think had a better game than I said in that live show, but I don't think was necessarily being trusted with combining in 1-2s and turning under pressure and picking up the ball and driving at opponents. I don't think that was what he was tasked with. I don't think Georgi Mihailovic really kind of stamped his authority down on this game. I saw him drifting wide a lot. So we did see a little bit of that rotation, but I didn't see him on the ball in the middle of the field so much. And I felt like they ended up having to go fullback and then down the channel maybe more than they would have liked. And that's where I'm interested in your perspective on, do you agree that that's a thing that kind of kept happening? And if so, do you think that was by design or because they didn't have the creativity to play through the middle?
I think it was more by design. And that's a good point because especially in the second half, Taylor, I noticed the U.S. going long and going more direct, especially to the wingers, Jonathan Lewis and Benji Michel and then Sebastian Saucedo later in the second half as well. I noticed them playing more direct, but I don't think that means that the midfielders that Jason Kreis has aren't trying to do the same job as the senior team. If you think about in January and in November, the two kind of big data points that we have for the U.S. senior team, the central midfielders back in January, Jackson Yule was the six. We see that again in this game. And then it was Sebastian Legette as the left center mid. And then Brendan Aaronson, I believe, as the right center mid. And then November, it was Tyler Adams as the six, different profile than Jackson Yule. And then it was Weston McKennie and Yunus Musa starting as the two central midfielders in both of those games. If we look especially at November, Weston McKennie and Yunus Musa are creative players in certain ways. They're good at driving the ball forward. They can play some passes, but they're not through ball threaders. They're not hyper creative players. They're not playmakers. Hassani Dotson and Georgi Mihailovic, I don't think are playmakers either. I think especially Dotson fits into that Weston McKennie, Yunus Musa role really well. He's a high pressure player, as in, yeah, that's a really terrible way to phrase that. He can press high up the field. He covers ground. He does the dirty work in midfield so that the center backs are the number six. We didn't see that from Jackson Yule in this game because of how Costa Rica marked him out of the game. But so that the U.S.'s creative players deeper down the field can play those passes. Dotson and Mihailovic or, you know, McKennie and Musa or Legette and Aaronson, they kind of do the dirty work, and it does change slightly based on the profile. And I think we'll talk about this more later with the senior team and their roster, and I think we might see some different things there. But based off of Dotson and Mihailovic, the two center mids that Jason Kreis picked in this game, I actually do think that those two players fit into the positional profiles that Berhalter is using and has used for his central midfielders in the 4-3-3 that we've seen starting in 2020.
So, but do you agree then that there wasn't as much creativity through the center, or did you see moments of that sort of make you okay with this caliber of player being the player that are starting there?
Not a lot of creativity through the center. Again, I think that has a lot to do with what Costa Rica were doing. The center backs, because of how Costa Rica defended the midfield really tight and compact, that put the impetus on Justin Glad and Mauricio Pineda to be the creators. I don't think in this game it was ever going to be Dotson and Mihailovic and even Jackson Yule making a lot of plays in midfield on the ball because they just didn't have a lot of time or space to do that. I thought Dotson especially found good spots between the lines to receive the ball, but then because there were so many players around him, all he could do was just lay the ball off quickly or turn quickly and play a quick pass up to the forward line or laterally to a fullback on his right side. I don't think the game was set up for them to really have dominant creative performances. Though I could be wrong, Taylor. I'm not saying this is the only way to look at it, but I don't know.
No, I think you're not. I think my like overall read and rewatching this game is that I think, and this isn't even a negative. I think it's understandable why you would do this, but I think this was a slightly more cautious approach from the U.S. I think you're right that they didn't want to gamble. They didn't want to get, like, try too much through the middle and get caught and leave themselves vulnerable to a counterattack right through the middle of the field. I think it was, if you look at Jackson Yule, for example, I agree that they man-marked him. They sat on him. He wasn't able to sort of have time and space, but I also think he wasn't really looking to create time and space. And that seems to have been a hotly debated topic, at least on the social medias, of should he have been moving? You know, Xavi didn't just sit there and wait for the ball. He moved around. And I understand both of those perspectives. But I think when a player does or doesn't do something repeatedly, and in this case, it's Jackson Yule not really vacating space, not trying to move out of the middle to open up for other players, I tend to, after the first couple times, see that as a deliberate pattern as opposed to a deliberate deficiency or an unintentional deficiency. And so to me, that was him being told, stay central, make sure that there's no quick counterattacking opportunities through the middle. If one of the center backs moves forward, you fill in. I felt like he tended to drop in for Pineda more so than Justin Glad, but I think that's because Pineda, to your original point about him, Joe, was the one who was responsible with bringing the ball forward and trying to play out. Sometimes that worked well, sometimes it didn't. But I do think that is sort of all to say that this was Jason Kreis wanting to win and wanting to get the result, but fundamentally not wanting to lose this game. And I think he set his team up just a little bit more cautiously than maybe we'll see against the Dominican Republic, for example. And again, I don't really blame him for that. I don't really even think that's a negative, but I do think it limits my ability to understand if this is the style of play that we'll see from this team going forward, and if all of these players can play more creative attacking soccer, because I think it was just a bit more of a cautious approach.
I think the best club profile, I've said this before, and I'm not the only person to have this thought, certainly. I think the best club profile for the US and the best comparison to them at a club level is Liverpool. And that's a very generous one. But as far as the general style goes, I think Liverpool's a really good relative comparison to how the US are trying to play right now. If you think about Liverpool's midfield, you've got...
I just want to clarify. I know people are like, what? What are you talking about, Joe? And we should clarify. I'm assuming you're talking about the good Liverpool when they were winning consistently.
Yes.
But
yes.
I want to emphasize, I am with you. I think this is a fair comparison.
I remember Taylor, and man, there are some real times where I miss, and a lot of times where I miss not doing these shows, where I miss having Daryl and you in my ears. Because I remember a specific conversation. I remember where I was listening to it as well. Hearing Daryl talk about Jesus Ferreira as Roberto Firmino, right? Yep. As that number nine who drops in. And I remember thinking, yeah, like that's right. I hope people see the connection, because Daryl's not saying Jesus Ferreira is Roberto Firmino. He's saying that he's playing a similar role. And that's a fantastic point. You can start at the top and look at the Liverpool to US comparison. Jesus Ferreira, or that number nine often dropping in, the wingers then running in behind. We saw that with Jonathan Lewis and Benji Michel running in behind. And then the midfield three, and this is why I started this point initially. You've got them a lot of times as this all-action trio. Jackson Yule doesn't really fall into that category, but the U.S. doesn't have the personnel or the depth that Liverpool does to have the exact profile spot on. But you've got Jackson Yule as the number six, or Tyler Adams as that, you know, all-action number six. And then it's two number eights. It's Wijnaldum and Thiago, who has a little bit more creative flair to him, or it's Wijnaldum and Fabinho, or Jordan Henderson, or James Milner, or Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, these guys that are really two-way players, less so for Fabinho in that regard. But you've got this all-action type of midfield that I think is what the U.S. are trying to replicate, and it's going to change based on the opponent. I believe it's going to change. Maybe for the senior team, you see Christian Pulisic play as a central midfielder, even though he doesn't fit that Wijnaldum profile. Maybe you see Gio Reyna in there, even though he's not this hard defensive runner. But roughly speaking, against quality teams, I think the U.S. is in a spot right now where they're best suited, and they most closely mirror Liverpool when they have two well-rounded number eights in that midfield in front of a number six. And that could be a Yule-style six, it could be an Adams-style six. But I think that's where the U.S. is going right now against tough opponents like Costa Rica was in this opening game.
Yeah. I also think the fullbacks of like fundamental importance to your attack, feels very Liverpool to me.
Yes.
And I do also think that that's part of where we saw some build out problems for the U.S. because, especially in the first half, I think Sam Vines and Herrera, when the center backs were on the ball, would advance pretty far forward. And there were multiple occasions in which Pineda's on the ball. Sometimes it's Yule, sometimes it's Glad. And there is nobody around them for like 15 or 20 yards. And you can try to force a ball through the middle, or you can try to play it out wide. Usually they end up going out wide. But the one that stood out to me the most was, flipping back in my notes, in the third minute. This is what I think the U.S. were trying to do, and I think Costa Rica had to adjust really quickly. But the ball goes to Pineda. Two different Costa Rican players, Martinez and Ugalde, try to put him under pressure really quickly, but they do it from different angles. And he, while facing like the opposite side of the field, plays the ball basically behind him into space for Sam Vines. And then Sam Vines goes down that channel. And because of that press from Costa Rica and kind of pulling them out, now there's tons of space. And that works really, really well. And I think that's why they keep trying to do that. The difference is that Costa Rica then adjusts, sit off a bit more, block those options. And instead of it being a sort of low pass on the ground, it becomes necessary for a chipped ball over the top. And that's when it starts going out of bounds. That's when you just get a little bit more erratic delivery. But I could see what the U.S. were doing. And again, that connects to the Liverpool idea of get it wide to your fullbacks who, if they're in space, they drive forward. And now the opponent has to adjust. They can then combine in an overload with the wide attackers, or the wide attackers can go central. And the number nine, who's a false nine, and Jesus Ferreira can then drift to different pockets of space and try to kind of find some opportunities there. I see a lot of what you're talking about. I think that then invites the question of, but if they don't have that midfield three capable of doing what Liverpool do or replicating what Liverpool do, why persist with that idea? Why not change it up? And I think the answer is because, number one, they want to do what Berhalter's senior team is going to be doing. They want to keep it consistent. But number two, you can't just like get rid of players because they don't specifically fit this one aspect of what you need them to do. You adjust it a little bit. And I think I still would have liked to see more movement from Jackson Ewell, but I don't think that he was necessarily the problem the way I think I've seen other people put it. I think that they adjusted their game to he's not going to be Tyler Adams. He's not going to charge around the field, as you said. So don't expect him to do that. Don't ask him to do that, because then you're putting him in a position to fail. Try to play to his strengths while fundamentally doing a lot of the same things. And I think for the most part in the first half, that's what the U.S. did.
Yeah, and can we talk about like the general flow of the game? Because I think that'd be helpful for context. Maybe we should have done that earlier, but hopefully a lot of folks watched it and have a pretty good idea of what happened already. But the U.S. started really strong in this game. Taylor, you touched on it just a minute ago. They started out really well, and I went back and rewatched it and had that realization of how good they were in the opening 5 minutes. They almost had a goal. Jesus Ferreira presses, wins the ball off of Costa Rica's right side at center back, takes a shot, it goes off the post. But, I mean, the game almost took a really nice turn right at the beginning for the United States. But even then after that, for the next few minutes, they start out well. They're moving the ball, especially up that left side, with Sam Vines as the primary attacking catalyst, bending in balls from the left wing. And then after that, the mistakes start to creep in. The U.S. starts to turn over the ball in bad spots. David Ochoa is called into action a few too many times for, I think, Jason Christ's comfort. But it's a lot of self-inflicted errors for the United States that lead to attacking chances for Costa Rica. And that kind of continues until about the 30th minute. The U.S. can't really generate many chances. They're struggling to break down that block. Jackson Ewell's being man-marked, so he can't be the distributor. Pineda and Glad are making mistakes left and right. And then right around the 30th minute, the 31st minute, things start to change. There's some good attacking sequences that I think then give the U.S. a little bit of momentum headed into their goal in the 34th minute. Is that right, Taylor? Shoot, I just lost it in my notes. Yeah, 35th minute. 35th minute from Jesus Ferreira. And I guess we can pause the game flow to talk about this, because it's a really nice goal, Taylor. How do we want to break this one down?
I mean, I think we can start with that it is, despite him mishitting a few balls over the top, it's Pineda going again for that sort of near diagonal is how I'll phrase that. It's not a long ball over
the
top, but it's that sort of, that's roughly what it is. But it's then Sam Vines, it's still a little bit overhit, and it's Sam Vines doing a great job to bring that ball down. And now, once again, as we're talking about, you have that channel a bit more open because you've bypassed some of the numbers that Costa Rica had set up. So we can go there with it, which is Sam Vines on the ball in the channel looking to play it in.
Yeah, Sam Vines gets that ball. As you said, it's a great touch. He moves forward up the left side and then bends the ball around, he bends the ball into the box. It's low. It's on the floor. It's a beautiful ball from Sam Vines, right in a spot where it's really difficult for Costa Rica to deal with it. And they can't deal with it. They get a little deflection on the ball, but it's Benji Michel and Asani Dotson, my favorite, who run into the box and force Costa Rica's far-sided center back and far-sided fullback down almost to the end line. And so they've drawn those players down. They've sucked those players down closer in to the goal, which then leaves space for Jesus Ferreira, who's had a really nice late arriving run in the box. He's not really bothered to get there too quickly because he knows what runs are being made around him. So he surveys the field really well. Ferreira does eventually crash in and cleans up the ball that Vines plays in, that took a little deflection, and finishes. It's an easy finish. Really nice movement from Dotson and Michel to occupy those Costa Rican defenders. Really nice ball from Sam Vines, and a great finish from Jesus Ferreira. You can't ask for much more.
No, you cannot. But I will add a few more details there. First of all, you say they run into the box. That is the definition of crashing the box.
Yeah.
Dotson and Michelle are both at full speed trying to get on the end of that cross. And what that does, even if they don't, is it makes the defenders have to react with the same level of intensity, which pulls them out. And now they're reacting to a cross and not necessarily paying attention to their marks. For Michelle, I thought it was especially good. Stu Holden, always very good at this, caught it in the moment, but he does then realize that ball is there for Jesus Ferrer to hit first time, and he gets out of the way. And that is such like an underrated thing to not potentially, because we've seen that before where a player standing in an offside position, the ball is hit, and then there's the question of, are they involved in the sequence? Should that goal be chalked off? And I think him just vacating the space as quickly as he can, it really is like, oh, that ball's getting hit, and he runs out of the way. That's great vision and awareness from him. But it's also really great vision and awareness from Jesus Ferreira, to your point, the late arriving run. We should clarify that it starts this whole sequence with a throw in on the right hand side from Herrera to Glad to Pineda. And then there's that diagonal. Maybe Jackson Ewell's in there too. But Jesus Ferreira has gone all the way back to be in a position to receive that throw in. And then rather than sort of turn and sprint forward because the ball's been played forward, Joe, you're absolutely correct. I think he recognizes, I don't need to do that. There's already people making that run. Let me hang back and evaluate the situation. And it's that sort of next level awareness that is so hard to have as a forward, because you are drilled, be in the box, get there. You got to be the one who's trying to put pressure on. You got to make the goalie make a decision. And so for him to kind of not do that, but instead recognize people are already doing that, let me put myself in a good position to, if that ball spills, I can get a good clean shot from a very good angle. And that's exactly how that went down. So I thought the goal itself was good, but the overall build up from the US was also good. And then the awareness from Jesus Ferreira was excellent. I would say the cherry on the top.
I would as well. Before we started recording, Taylor, you texted me, I'm going to watch a little bit of Mexico and the Dominican Republic in their game that happened right after the U.S.'s game. Mexico wins that 4-1. Not unexpected, right? Not an unexpected result. But you sent me that text and I was like, well, you know, I don't want to be shown up here. I want to watch some too. So I went and watched the first 30 minutes of that game, and I watched the goals.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Mexico generated a lot of their attacks by having their central midfielders in their 4-3-3. So their two number eights making late arriving runs into the box. They had those two guys running into the box late after the defense had been sucked down closer to the end line. That's exactly what happened here for the U.S. Jesus Ferreira almost ran in as a central midfielder instead of as a striker. And I just want to give credit in a weird, twisted way to FC Dallas, because they've played him a lot as a central midfielder. Maybe there's a tie in there, but just to give listeners an idea of a little bit of how Mexico attack, and then also about how Jesus Ferreira made that run. It's a really great run. He's patient. He runs like an 8 and not as much like a 9.
I would agree with you. Still a little bit more to talk about from this game, and looking ahead to the Dominican Republic, then the senior roster, some Champions League draw, but first a word from today's sponsors.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We are back, and we are going to talk about the second half, which I think last night when we did the live show, I was inclined to say was fundamentally different from the first half. I felt like the U.S. was more erratic, more panicky. I think they were a bit more reactionary. They attacked down the channels. In watching it again, I feel like there's not that much difference between the first and the second half. I think it's just that Costa Rica pressed more often, pressed more readily, and caused more discomfort to the U.S. But watching the first half again and realizing how often they targeted the flanks and tried to get in behind and really did prioritize, again, the Liverpool analogy, kind of 1v1 take-ons from Jonathan Lewis from... it was Jonathan Lewis on the left, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Jonathan Lewis on the left and from Benji Michel on the right. And even when Bofo Salcedo comes in, same thing. I think those wide attackers are told, take people on, go at people, make something happen almost on an individual level and see what you can do. And I felt like they were still trying to do that. I think Costa Rica, just as you've already said, Joe, like had the lungs, had the legs, and were able to weather that a bit more, apply more pressure, and cause more problems for the U.S.
Yeah, I think in the first few minutes of this game, I could hear Jason Kreis yelling at Jonathan Lewis to take someone on. And I'm guessing that continued into the second half. The U.S. went more direct, partially because Costa Rica was taking it to him. Costa Rica controlled this second half, forced the U.S. back into more of a 4-5-1 block instead of a 4-3-3 press. So the U.S. was more congested, more, you know, more pinned back in their half because of how dangerous Costa Rica's wide players, how dangerously they were attacking. It was Luis Diaz and Randall Leal mostly on that right side with Ian Smith overlapping that caused the U.S. a lot of problems. They almost always had a 3v2 on Vines and Mihailovic or Vines and Jackson Ewell once Andres Perea comes in and plays as the six and shifts Ewell to that left-sided number eight spot. Costa Rica looked really good, and Taylor, the U.S. looked tired. That was my biggest takeaway when I watched this game back. I didn't think about it as much, but we talked about it already in this show. The U.S. is not in season. Costa Rica is in season. Yeah, Luis Diaz and Randall Leal actually aren't, but the rest of that squad is, and when you're not having to do as much running all the time, that gives you a boost for these late-game situations because the players around you have been doing the running all game long, and they're fit and ready to do that. So Leal and Luis Diaz looked pretty sharp and pretty fit throughout this entire game, but we saw rust from the U.S. in a couple ways. I think in the first half, we saw it with a lot of sloppy turnovers. We saw that in the second half some as well. But then in the second half, really, we saw just a lot of tired legs, and the U.S. lost control. And I was a little bit concerned about that after first watch, but then taking a breath and realizing, you know, some context in this game, how these guys aren't playing, I think it's okay that the U.S. sat a little bit deeper. They were trying to get this result because this is a must-win game in terms of your ability to qualify for the Olympics. And the U.S. did enough in their lower defensive shape to make that happen.
Yeah, because I think you're right. Because I think if you look at the way Jason Kreis adjusts his team, you talked about that substitution where Perea goes and sits in the middle. Jackson Ewell goes like out to the left. Georgi Mihailovic comes off. And then later on in the game, after he's already brought on Bofo Salcedo, to be more like, I think, of an attacking outlet to sort of go at Costa Rica, hopefully drive them back a little bit and just sort of be an attacking threat. I think there's an awareness of that really hasn't had the intended effect. Diaz is still able to sort of create overloads and get down the U.S.'s left-hand side, Costa Rica's right. So that's where you see Julian Araujo comes on. Saucedo goes to the right-hand side, and now Araujo is tasked with probably staying back and blocking that off and giving more defensive support. And I thought those adjustments were good in-game changes to deal with what Costa Rica were throwing at the U.S. For Costa Rica's part, I think I already talked about the one time that their sort of press was bypassed in the second minute. I think the blueprint for their second half is in the 17th minute. That's that moment where we have Pineda get robbed because he's a little bit slow on the ball and ends up with a great save from David Ochoa. But I think that was maybe coming out of for the second half for Costa Rica. They had kind of pinpointed that as these guys are sort of slow on the ball. They're expecting to have time on the ball. They're not going to try to play through the middle. They're not going to try to create through the middle. And certainly, as they're seeing out the game, they're not going to try to do that. So let's go at them. Let's make them more uncomfortable. I think they did that. I think they succeeded. I think that's a big reason why the U.S. looked sloppier in the second half, as well as the fatigue. And with that in mind, again, like, that's a thing that we've seen happen at senior level, at youth level, where they're up 1-0 and they end up losing 2-1 because you concede one goal, but you've made these defensive changes. Now the momentum is with the other team. Maybe they get a second goal late in the game, or sometimes maybe it's that equalizer late in the game. And so, again, not the prettiest result, not the prettiest game overall, but for the United States to get a 1-0 win in the opening round of a qualifying competition that they needed to win. They needed to win this game. They definitely needed not to lose it. And I think more than anything else, that's the takeaway. They won. They got 3 points. They scored a goal. There were some positives. There were some negatives, but you can address those and deal with them. But overall, a result is a result.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I think you're spot on there. Taylor, before we leave this game, do we want to do kind of like best performances, worst performances, or at least best performances to highlight some of the guys in maybe just a little bit greater detail that really balled out in this one?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Jesus Ferreira. I would just emphasize that aside from scoring the goal, I thought he was a big reason why there were some cases, especially in the first half, when the U.S. could play through the middle, because he would. There were times when he was like standing next to Jackson Ewell, and now you've got a 2v1 with that man marking system. There were times when he would like overload one side if Georgi Mihailovic went out to the left wing. Jesus Ferreira would fill in there and receive the ball. And I thought he was not just moving into that space, but you could see him demanding the pass. And in a game when distribution was at times erratic, I will say that there are games in which I don't feel like I can take a risk. There are games, this is obviously at amateur level, but when you're playing a very good team, there, you're just a little bit less likely to try to force a ball in than when you're 3-0 up on a team where you think you can pull it off. And sometimes you need that teammate to say, play the ball to my feet, I want the ball. And it almost like removes responsibility from you to, like, if this person is screaming for the ball and demanding it, to some extent you're like, well, I better play it to them. And I think, weirdly, it removes some of the decision making, and instead you're playing by reflex. And I think that is what you're aiming for in soccer, is to always be playing by like the mental reflex that you've trained for and built up. And Jesus Ferreira demanding that ball, wanting that ball in space, I think helped calm people down a little bit in possession. So he was one who on second viewing I liked even more than I already liked on first viewing, and I liked him a lot on first viewing.
I'm with you on Ferreira. I think Sam Vines did nothing to dissuade me from the fact that I think he should be in the U.S.'s best roster right now, the top roster for whatever competition Berhalter's prioritizing this summer. David Ochoa, we talked about him already. He was phenomenal in this game. I do think Asani Dotson was really good, and maybe that's just because I didn't know what to expect from him coming in, but I posted a couple of clips on Twitter of him covering a ridiculous amount of ground, beating players that he had no business beating to a ball, and then driving the ball forward, breaking the game open, or providing an important pass to key an attacking sequence. I thought he was really good as well in this game. And then I really like Andres Perea. I know we saw him against Trinidad back in January. He was good in a lot of moments and really poor in other moments, just inconsistent in his first cap. I thought he was strong coming off the bench in this game. The way he moves and the way he passes the ball really intrigue me. I think he's got a big upside. I'm excited to see him more with Orlando City this year. So yeah, those guys are definitely my standout performers from this game.
So I gotta say, Joe, I love that you, what was the tweet you put out? Was it a love story?
A two-part love story, because there were two clips.
Yes. And I think it made me really happy, because we at the end of our recording last night, we kind of talked about like what are some things we're going to try to pay attention to. I had said I didn't always love Dotson's positioning. You were sort of more optimistic about his game overall. Watching it again, those two moments I have in my notes as being the moments of like, yeah, I was too harsh on Dotson. Like he did a lot on the ball as well as a better job off the ball than I thought he did. And then I saw your tweets and it made me even happier because I was like, yep, I agree. Dotson was good. My bad, Joe. Good call by you.
We're on the same page, and he wasn't flawless. He's still raw on the ball, and at this point in his career, I'm not sure that's really going to change. But he does a lot of things really well, and I think is a good fit for that number eight profile that Berhalter seems to be moving towards. So I'm here for it.
Yeah, I am as well. I talked about him already. We talked about him a lot on the Stereo Show, and I feel like that's probably why we haven't talked about him as much. But just emphasizing again, David Ochoa, really strong performance at a time when they absolutely needed that. You need that feeling of security behind you. If he does mishandle one or if he does have an errant pass, again, I think it just hurts the confidence a little bit. You're not quite sure if they're going to be as rock solid if you play the ball back to them. So, you know what? Maybe I won't play it this time. And I think there were never any concerns for me with Ochoa in goal. The final little thing I wanted to mention, and then we will definitely move on because I think we've done plenty about this game. You mentioned the Dominican Republic's 4-1 loss to Mexico. I did also take a look at that one just because I wanted to sort of have an idea of what they're going to do, what the United States can do. Joe, my read was when they're attacking, they're in a relatively tight 4-4-2. When they're defending, it almost becomes a 4-2-3-1 with one of those kind of front two dropping into the right-hand side. And I thought the other thing I noticed from them was that they crowded numbers on one side of the field or the other. So if Mexico has the ball with their left back, I routinely saw like Dominican Republic's like left winger and left back basically playing centrally. Like they really crowd numbers to one side and I think try to make it really hard to build out. Those are a couple things I noticed. Did you notice those too? Do you agree with those or are there other things that you spotlighted?
I noticed that they changed their shape at one point. They started out defending in a low to mid 4-5-1 block and then they switched it, I think, to that 4-4-1-1, that 4-2-3-1 that you're talking about. That can get narrow, but the Dominican Republic's MO is to sit deep in their half, make life difficult for you, congest space, and then attack pretty directly when they do get on the ball. And I think those are things that the U.S. has likely been expecting, and hopefully they'll be ready to break down a block because I think that's going to be their biggest task against the Dominican Republic.
And the way Mexico get their opener, for people who haven't seen it, is they stay focused on that left-hand side of the field. I kept waiting for like the big switch or the big swing around to the opposite side, and you're kind of trying to pull the Dominican Republic apart or stretch them out, and then you've got openings to attack. And they didn't do that. They basically just kept combining down that left-hand side, and then it's across into the box, and it's the late arriving runs that leads to that first goal. And that was a thing that they had already been trying in that first half. And so I think the United States continuing to go down the wings, but just maybe getting a little bit sharper there, but then having people crashing the box again, I think that's going to open up some opportunities. Mexico's second goal is from a good set-piece delivery, but there's nothing really fancy about it. It's just the Dominican players not doing a very good job of tracking. They let their mark see at goal side, or they let the people they're supposed to be marking get goal side, and it's a goal. I think I contrast that with Georgi Mihailovic's delivery on his set pieces. Sometimes good, sometimes the corner is under hit and Glad has to kind of stoop to head it. Sometimes the free kick is struck wide. There was another set piece where he went for like sort of a designed one, but nobody was on the same page and he just passed it straight out of bounds. I think the U.S., maybe if they spend a little bit more time practicing some of those set pieces, I think that will certainly help them. So I hope we see the U.S. looking sharper on set pieces and maybe getting a goal there and then opening up the Dominican Republic from there.
Yeah, I'm excited. That game is Sunday afternoon, depending on where you are. And we'll be talking about it once it happens. We'll have another show on that. That's right, isn't it, Taylor?
That is correct, my friend. I think my plan is to either be on the weekend review with Graham and Ryan or let them handle that one. And you and I can talk a little bit U.S. and Americans abroad on Monday. But either way, we will have a review show of that one out early next week. Anything else from the USA's 1-0 win over Costa Rica, Joe, before we move on?
I don't think so, Taylor.
All right. We've gone long on that one, but I'm okay with it because again, meaningful soccer is meaningful and exciting.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Less meaningful but still significant would be the U.S. senior team's upcoming friendlies. March 25th, we are playing Jamaica in Austria, of course, 1 p.m. That will be on ESPN2, Unimas and TUDNA. March 28th, 12 p.m. coverage beginning, which means I think probably 12:30 kickoff. Northern Ireland in Belfast, that one's on Fox. First of all, of course, the game that's on ESPN2 is listed at 1 p.m. and the game at 12 p.m. is listed as coverage beginning at 12 p.m. when it's on Fox. Fox did this to me again last night. They started not at the time that they said they would, just a little bit later. Joe, why must they do this?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It really perturbs us all. Let's just put it that way.
All right. Let's put it that way, and let's just instead talk about this roster, which we do now have. We haven't yet discussed, Joe, so let's maybe take it position by position. Just kind of general thoughts. Are we okay with it? Any outliers? Anything we're most excited to see? Starting with goalkeepers, we've got Ethan Horvath from Club Bruges, Chituro Odunze, the aforementioned, sort of, from Leicester City, and Zach Steffen of Man City. It still feels like Zach Steffen is our number one until somebody really, really rises in Greg Berhalter's estimation. But for now, I think it's Steffen for sure. The number two spot, I think, is a bit more wide open. And it could be Horvath. Maybe it's Odunze. Maybe it's Ochoa after this game. Brad Guzan, I think, is theoretically still in that conversation. Lots of other names potentially as well.
Matt Turner.
Joe, where
Matt
are you
Turner.
On
Sorry.
Our...
Matt Turner.
Excuse me, Matt Turner, of course. I apologize. Please, MLS Twitter, don't come for me. Joe, where are you on what you would like to see here? Would you like to see Steffen starting one game and then Horvath and Odunze splitting halves? Would you like to see, like, Horvath or Odunze get a whole game? Is there anything in particular you want to see from the goalkeepers in these friendlies?
I'd like to see two full games from Zach Steffen. There's really no reason why I wouldn't. I don't think Ethan Horvath or Odunze are in contention to be the number one or even in the top three. Maybe Horvath is third. I don't know. But Zach Steffen is not having to leave the camp early. There are seven players on this roster that are going to have to go after the Jamaica game because of COVID restrictions in the countries that they play in. So all of the Bundesliga guys, I believe that's six of them. And then Tim Weah for Lille. Oh, and Reggie Cannon from Boavista. So five
Reggie
Bundesliga,
mm-hmm.
then one from the Portuguese First Division, and then one from Ligue 1. So you're losing players.
Brooks Cannon, Richards, Adams, Reyna, Weah, Sargent.
Perfect. You're losing all of those guys, but you're not losing any goalkeepers. So give Zach Steffen mm-hmm. the reps. Let's see what he can do. Continue to get looks at him, distributing and shot stopping. I don't think I could ask for much more.
I don't think I could either. And I don't think I'll be able to ask for much more if things go the way I think they will when it comes to our defenders, for reasons you've already mentioned. We've got 10 defenders on this roster. John Brooks, Reggie Cannon, Serginho Dest, Aaron Long, Matt Miazga, Eric Palmer-Brown, Tim Ream, Brian Reynolds, Chris Richards, Anthony Robinson, Aaron Long, the lone MLS player making it into the defensive ranks. Well done, Aaron Long. But it is John Brooks leaving, as you said, after that first game. It is Chris Richards leaving after that first game. To me, that says we're going to get a John Brooks, Chris Richards partnership for that first friendly against Jamaica, which could or will feature Mikel Antonio now that he has officially switched his allegiance. I don't know if that paperwork has to be filed or what will have to happen to make that occur. But I do think we're going to get Brooks and Richards playing together. Joe, are you on that same page?
I'm on the same page, and it's that opinion and outlook is only strengthened by the fact that those two guys have to leave. Even if they didn't, mm-hmm. I'd hope that that would be the first choice center back pairing. Agreed. Chris Richards, I think, has earned it with his time at Hoffenheim, and hopefully he would continue to show that in camp so he could really earn it in front of Greg Berhalter. But those two guys are the two best center backs in the pool right now, in my view. There's no reason for them not to start against Northern Ireland and then against Jamaica, excuse me. And then maybe you get Miazga and Long or Ream and Long. It doesn't really matter in the second game, as far as I'm concerned. Like it just doesn't. It doesn't, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. And we are going to do more of an in-depth preview as we get closer to these games. But there's lots of other soccer between now and then. The other one, we've already said Reggie Cannon will be leaving after the first game. Do you think that means we are locked in to get Reggie Cannon starting at right back? And if so, does that move Dest to left back in your mind? Does that mean Anthony Robinson is there? Do you think we might see Tim Ream in the return to the kind of left center back experiment?
I think the two most likely fullback pairings in game one are Reggie Cannon at right back, Dest at left back, or Dest at right back, Robinson at left back, and we just don't see a start from Cannon. Maybe he comes off the bench and plays the last 30 minutes of the second half. And to be honest, I guess maybe I'm not apathetic about this. I'm really excited about these games, but I'm finding it really hard to be bothered one way or the other about if it's Cannon and Dest or Dest and Robinson. I don't think it'll be Brian Reynolds starting this first game. He could get minutes. He could get a start in the second game, or maybe just minutes off the bench in the second game.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll see Tim Ream as a left back. I think the positional profile that Berhalter has for that spot has moved away from the stay-at-home left back. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to see Dest get a start. And if it's Cannon or Robinson against Jamaica, I'm not really too fussed one way or the other.
I'm not saying this is a thing I want to see happen, but I do, to your point, feel like maybe we're going to start seeing fewer center backs called in. I feel like Tim Ream might be one of those that we don't see as regularly going forward, but we'll have to keep an eye on that one. But you mentioned Brian Reynolds. I think this is also like, I'm really excited to see him. A lot of this roster is just sort of like, yeah, that makes sense. Good for them. And this feels like hey, good for you. Way to make that move. Way to make your debut for Roma. I'm sorry the commentator didn't like you for whatever reason, but we're going to put you in camp. Yeah, that feels like getting a few minutes, like 10 or 15 minutes at the end of one of these games, and that will be fine. But yeah, congratulations to Brian Reynolds. Anything else about the defense before we move to midfield?
This is not an original thought from me. I saw it from Matt Doyle, who wrote a good column on MLSsoccer.com about this roster and these two upcoming games. And Doyle was saying that it's possible we see a three at the back shape from the U.S. maybe in that second game against Northern Ireland, which could explain why there are so many center backs on this roster. There are six of them, all told. You lose two, you still have four for the second game. Maybe we see a three something something like we saw against Jamaica in that pre-Gold Cup friendly back in 2019? I think 2019. So just something to file away. Again, not an original thought from me, but something that I do think is technically possible.
That would make sense because you usually, I mean, if you've got 10 defenders there, usually what you're going for is your starters and then cover for your starters, which would be 8. If you're going with a back 3 plus 2 wing backs, now you need 10, and that's what we've got. I feel like that's some good math by Matt Doyle, but I'm giving you the credit instead. So good work by you, Joe.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I will take credit over Doyle literally anytime.
That's fair, and you should. In midfield, 7 players. Brendan Aaronson of RB Salzburg. Red Bull Salzburg, I guess we can say. Kellen Acosta of the Colorado Rapids. Tyler Adams, RB Leipzig. Luca De La Torre, Heracles. We've talked about him recently. Sebastian Legette of the LA Galaxy. Yunus Musa, Valencia. Owen Odosowi, Wolverhampton. Hi, Yunus Musa. Thanks for choosing the USA. It's very nice to see you. This could be a different roster with him not on it, and a sadder roster, I would add.
Yeah, this is a much, much more happy conversation for having Yunus Musa in it. I think we'll see him start one or both of these games. It's a quick turnaround. It's a Thursday, Sunday, which is what we're seeing from these U23s down in Mexico as well right now. So I don't know how much repeat we'll see from starters who play against Jamaica if they play a full 90 or even if they play 60. But I think we'll see Yunus Musa start against Jamaica. We'll see Tyler Adams start against Jamaica as a guy who has to go home after that first game. Then maybe it's Sebastian Legette, or, I mean, it could be really a number of different guys. It could be Aaronson, though I think he might be a better fit as a winger. It could even, Taylor, be Gio Reyna playing as a central midfielder, or even Christian Pulisic, even though those guys don't fit the profile that I feel like I kind of bent over backwards to detail earlier, and I'm going to look really bad if that doesn't happen. But at the same time, I think I made it clear we could see different players in those midfield spots depending on the opponent. If Berhalter just wants to get a look at Reyna as an 8 or Pulisic as an 8 in this new look tactical setup that's changed really since Christian Pulisic even had a chance to play for this squad last, we could see one of those guys play as an 8 without Weston McKennie, because that's a big notable absence. He's hurt. He's still with Juve. They didn't have him coming to this camp because he's not fully fit. So there is an 8 spot open, and it could be filled by Aaronson or Legette or Acosta or even Odesoe or De La Torre. I just named all of them. Or it could be filled by Pulisic or Reyna. My money would go on Reyna.
I think that that's not an incorrect assumption because, again, with players leaving after that first game from the forward line, we'll just go through them really quickly. Daryl Dike, Nicola Gioacchini, Christian Pulisic, Gio Reyna, Josh Sargent, Tim Weah. Reyna, Sargent, and Weah would be the three that are leaving after the first game. So it stands to reason that you want to maybe see what Sargent can do up top. It seems like you'd want to give Timothy Weah a start out wide. And then you probably want to get Gio Reyna in there if he then has to leave, but I doubt you're going to sit Christian Pulisic. So it does make sense to have Pulisic and Reyna, like one as like that left side at number 8, one like maybe out on the left wing, and you can kind of have them rotate or see how that goes. I think your instincts are probably pretty accurate there, Joe. You never know what Greg Berhalter is going to do. Maybe he doesn't start Pulisic. Maybe he doesn't start one of those gentlemen who might be leaving. But either way, I wouldn't say that just because someone's listed as a midfielder or someone's listed as a forward and not a midfielder doesn't mean that we won't get some positional rotation.
And we're starting to get to a point in the pool where good players are either going to be left off of rosters. No Matthew Hoppe, no Jordan Cibaciu, no DeAndre Yedlin, partly due to COVID, but partly due to you can't really bring 87,000 players into a squad. So we're starting to get to that point, but we're also getting to the point where good players can't all play. The U.S. has more outfield players you'd love to see get a start in their natural positions that Berhalter just can't accommodate right now. And that's a good place to be, even though it's going to create some dissension amongst people actually watching these games.
I agree. And we will lose some of those players, some of those names. There's always going to be some conversation about why no this person, why no that person. And to that I say, a potential midfield of Tyler Adams, Yunus Musah, and Christian Pulisic, or Gio Reyna with Christian Pulisic out wide, I'm really excited about that. like I'm sad Weston McKennie isn't here, but I just feel like there's so many exciting players that we could get to see in these friendlies that we've seen before or not seen before, but haven't seen in this context. I just think it's a strong roster with a lot of fun possibilities and less like, I don't know how that's going to work. This doesn't make sense to me. Like, I just think no matter what the 11 is in one game or the next, I think there's going to be reasons to watch and reasons for enthusiasm and reasons just to care because this team is getting better and there is depth there. And you never know who's going to break through next and who will become that regular player and who they'll supplant as a result. So I don't know. I didn't think I could be more hyped about this roster, Joe, but talking about it, albeit very briefly, has made me even more excited.
Yeah, it's a great group of players. A lot of guys I'm very excited to see. A lot of players who are age eligible to be playing down in Mexico right now with the U23s, but they're just not doing that because they're kind of too good. Like they've made the move in their career where it's not as feasible for them to travel back and play these games while their clubs need them. So yeah, I mean, it's a good reminder of where the pool is at right now and how far it's come. There's still so much more to go. But always, it's always fun to be reminded of the fact that there are actually good American soccer players on the men's side right now.
That there are. Are there still good Americans left in the Champions League? A look at the fixture says there are. Joe Lowry, should we talk Champions League? Anything else on the U.S. roster before we jump to our final topic of the day?
No, let's carry on. Nothing would make me happier to talk Champions than talking Champions League draw.
All right. So Ryan and Graham and myself reviewed the second legs of this week's games, and we talked about it, I think, very briefly. But I don't know, Joe, I just wanted to ask you, were you excited by like any of the games this week? Because it felt like there were some interesting ones going into them, and then a lot of the games within like 30 minutes felt like they were pretty much over. It was, I guess what I'm saying is this felt like an anticlimactic Champions League week, especially compared to some of the results we got the week before. What did you make of this week's action?
I'll never say no to high-level soccer, but pretty much outside of Chelsea, Atletico Madrid.
Yep.
And maybe Real Madrid, Atalanta. I don't think the other two fixtures were super high stakes just because Bayern Munich were pretty good in that first leg against Lazio. They were dominant in moments.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Manchester City never looked threatened by Mönchengladbach. So yeah, certainly not the pinnacle of Champions League action, but man, I think a lot of good teams advanced and I'm really excited for these quarterfinal games.
I just went back and looked at my notes and can now tell you that I'm with you that I thought Real Madrid Atalanta could be really exciting because I thought Atalanta would do different things and cause problems. I thought the same thing of Atletico. Both games featured a goal in the 34th minute. Benzema scores in the 34th for Madrid, and it was Ziyech scoring in the 34th for Chelsea. So it was the 34th minute that kind of killed both those ones off for me. My assumption would be that our quarterfinal round will give us some slightly more exciting matches. Well, we're just going to go through them one by one. We've got Manchester City versus Borussia Dortmund, FC Porto v Chelsea, Bayern Munich v PSG, Real Madrid versus Liverpool. Joe, is there one of those that speaks to your heart more than any others?
I love a good 2018 Champions League final rematch, yep. But more than that, I think I love just the sheer speed that I think Bayern Munich versus PSG is going to be played at.
That's also last year's rematch, isn't it?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're right. Last wow. year, did soccer even happen last year, Taylor? Like, can we
say what? I only know that because they posted Bayern Munich's winning streak, and I was like, did they win the Champions League last year? And I had to look it up, and they did. So there you go. That's the only reason why I know that.
I mean, you've got Serge Gnabry and Leroy Sané sprinting down the wings, Kingsley Coman potentially as well. And then you've got Kylian Mbappe running circles around everyone. I think Mbappe is going to cause Bayern Munich some real problems. Their back line has struggled defensively. The whole team struggled defensively at some points this season. That's Munich's biggest weakness. PSG is well equipped to exploit that, just like they exploited Barcelona in the first leg. And then I'm really excited for Porto-Chelsea as well, just because Porto's playing spoiler. They spoiled Juventus's time in the Champions League. And I think that could play out in a way that's going to really closely mirror how Chelsea played against Atletico Madrid in that first leg. Chelsea have to break Atletico Madrid down. They actually don't really do that, but they get a goal in transition in that first leg, courtesy of Olivier Giroud. Porto is going to play similarly to how Atletico Madrid played, and we're going to try to see Thomas Tuchel take a similar approach, break that team down, or find another way to get goals. That has me excited. And the other games do as well. I'm not saying that Man City-Dortmund isn't a fun one. That's going to be wild to see how Dortmund yep. manages to implode. And then, yeah, as I said, the 2018 Champions League final rematch, you really can't complain about that either.
I mean, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. I think that's why initially I was like, ooh, City Dortmund, it's going to be great. And then I was like, but is it though?
Cause
I think it will be juggernaut and Dortmund could make it great, but you're right. It could also be 3-0 in the first half of the first leg. And then I am less sad.
If there's one player that can break Manchester City, it's uh-huh. Erling Haaland. It
that is
Erling
true.
Haaland. And so that alone makes this game so exciting. Great players simplify tactics. Erling Haaland simplifies tactics and could make life miserable for Manchester City.
It's a good call because a big part of what City do with the professional fouling and with trying to kind of limit service through the middle is to pin opponents back. But when you have Erling Haaland, you always have that sort of long ball outlet. So yeah. Have City do what they do, but negate that threat. It's a good call, Joe. And that's going to be really fascinating. Madrid-Liverpool, also really interesting because it's two sort of juggernauts. It's a rematch, as you said. And yet at the same time, it's two teams that have a lot of question marks around them right now. There's injuries. There's who fits the best. There's, is this player still the best player for us anymore? Should this be the manager? Is a weird conversation that's being had about both of these clubs to varying degrees, which I don't fully get because yes, they should be. But I think that's like, it's almost the perfect draw because you're getting sort of two wounded animals that are also very, very good, and how they respond and what they do will be really, really cool to see. But Bayern Munich versus PSG, I cannot wait for, because it's similar in that it's Bayern Munich who have the appearance of being this juggernaut, but are having to start 17-year-olds in games because they don't have the depth, because they don't have the because they have the injuries, having to rotate players and kind of figure things out as they go. Versus PSG under Pochettino, who are never going to be accused of being the most consistent team, but I think he still has brought a level of confidence and maybe swagger to them. So how they deal with Bayern, what their setup is in that first leg with Bayern, I believe, at home. Oh, we've got some good games, Joe. I love the Champions League.
So do I. And they gave us a semifinal bracket, so it's going to be the winner of Bayern Munich PSG versus City and Dortmund playing on one half of the bracket, and then it's the winner of Real Madrid Liverpool playing Porto and Chelsea on the other side. And I, part of me really wishes that we'd gotten to see a Bayern Munich Man City final. But even then, the semifinals are set up to be really entertaining no matter who plays. So I'm so excited, Taylor. These games are going to be happening, these quarterfinal games, on April 6th and 7th. That's the first leg. And then the second legs will be played on April 13th and 14th. So we don't have too much longer to wait until we have more Champions League action right in front of us.
So on that one side, we do not. On that one side, so we could get City versus PSG going through, so the oil money derby, or we could get Bayern versus Dortmund, and we get the German derby, which means we'll get one of each going through, is pretty much how that will work.
I'm here for the oil money derby. It's science. Just to be clear.
Yeah. I feel like there's a, is it El Clasico? I forget what they call
one. That's good. That's good.
All right. Well, Joe, I appreciate your taking all the time to talk about many different competitions with me today. Lots of exciting enthusiasm for soccer because soccer's pretty exciting. Anything else to add before we call this one a day and go off to enjoy our weekends?
I have nothing. Taylor, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We don't usually get to record on Friday, so I feel like hopefully I'm sending you off into a slightly more relaxing weekend than you've had week. But either way, I hope your weekend is enjoyable, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you, as always.
Right back at you, buddy listeners. I also hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will be back next week with a lot more soccer talk. But for now, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you all again very soon.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.